Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. Well, this morning I have something here for you to do as we begin the conversation, something I'd like you to imagine. Imagine, if you can, the entire Earth covered in ice. Scientists now believe that, many scientists believe that if you go back in round figures, about 600 million years into the history of the Earth, there was a time when there was a lot of very dramatic glacial activity. Some, in fact, believe so dramatic that indeed there was a point when the Earth froze over completely, that this period then was followed, you know, perhaps some millions of years later, by a very dramatic thaw. It got dramatically warmer. And in fact, some scientists believe that this went back and forth several times, and that there is good evidence, if you look at the geology around the world, to believe that, in fact, that that happened, and that it's also connected to the explosion of complex life that we see on the Earth roughly about 600 million years ago, the Cambrian explosion. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a scientist. He's a geologist who is one of the leading proponents of this idea that has been called snowball Earth, not a term that he came up with, but another scientist came up with the term. He has looked at a lot of the evidence, and he believes that, in fact, there's a good reason to believe that that this did happen in this way. His name is Paul Hoffman. He is Sturgis Hooper Professor of Geology at Harvard University, and he is here to talk a little bit about this theory, snowball Earth, as a part of a long series of talks, and we've had some different guests here on the program who were here to talk in this series, to mark the centennial of the Illinois State Geological Survey. He will be giving a talk about snowball Earth this afternoon at 4 o'clock in room 228 of the Natural History Building on the U of I campus. That's on West Green, 1301 West Green, on the Urbana side of things. And I'm sure that anyone interested in attending should feel welcome. It's open to the public. And here this morning on the program, if you have questions, we would be happy to take them. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Dave.
Tell us, snowball Earth, what would the Earth have been like, have looked like at this point?
Well, it would have started slowly. You wouldn't have really noticed it because the mountain glaciers would start to get larger and they'd coalesce and they'd form little ice caps and they'd get larger and coalesce and they'd form ice sheets and these would creep slowly southwards from the North Pole and northwards from the South Pole. Eventually they'd expand just like the more recent ice ages that last one 20,000 years ago. Eventually the ice sheets would reach the ocean, but they wouldn't stop. They'd keep on creeping, and the thing about ice is it's white. And so most of the sunlight that falls on ice gets bounced back to space. It's reflected and lost. So there's a feedback to any climate change, because if it gets colder, you get more ice, and therefore less of the incoming solar radiation is absorbed, so you get an additional cooling effect.
And it just it snowballs.
And so this is because the Earth is a sphere. It's like a lot of middle-aged people. It's a lot bigger around the middle than it is in the top and bottom. So as these polar ice caps expand towards the equator, for every 100 kilometers that they move equatorward, the area that changes from dark to white gets bigger and bigger, so that feedback gets stronger. And at a point, there's what's called an instability in physics, and the feedback becomes unstoppable, and the ice caps then quickly expand, meet at the equator, and the entire Earth, including the oceans, are then covered by glacial ice hundreds to thousands of meters thick.
Yeah. I gather that the scientist who really first advanced this idea, the person who coined this term, that one of the things that caught his interest was the fact that there are certain kinds of geological material that is the signature of a glacier that says to you, at this place there was a glacier, and that he looked around the world And he found it all over the place, and even in places where you would think, well, it's too warm here. You can't have a glacier here. At equatorial regions, you'd think, well, there's no way that we're going to have a glacier here. And yet he said, this is everywhere, and you've got to have some way to explain this.
Yeah, there's clear geological evidence that ice was flowing into the ocean and right down at sea level close to the equator. Hmm. So there's ice on the equator today, but it's, you know, 5,000 meters above sea level in the highest mountains. But this is ice that's actually right down at sea level. Now, the irony is that physicists had already come up with the idea of how you could make a snowball Earth using this albedo argument. But they assumed it could never have actually happened because life would be extinguished and you wouldn't have to come to class this morning. So they assumed that it could have happened, but lucky for us, it didn't. And they also didn't think there would be any escape. You know, if the Earth becomes so white and most of the solar radiation is being reflected, how do you ever melt the ice?
Well, that was the two big questions that people asked. They said, well, okay, let us assume this happened. It would be, as far as we know, that there would be no unthawing. It would be permanent. No. And then there's this other question let us assume that it happened and it did thaw.
Yeah.
Nothing would have survived it. So yeah. we would have a dead planet. How does one try to explain the issue of, okay, once you've got the entire planet frozen over, how would it ever thaw out?
Yeah. So Joe Kirschfink, the guy who came up with the name Snowball Earth and who was the first one who actually thought that an event like this had happened in Earth history, he also realized that a Snowball Earth is actually self-destructive. And it's because plate tectonics is the salvation. Plate tectonics is the source of the carbon dioxide that we need in our atmosphere for the greenhouse effect. Plate tectonics will continue, doesn't care if there's kilometer of ice floating on the ocean. Carbon dioxide will still come out of volcanoes into the atmosphere and into seawater. But there'd be no way of getting rid of the carbon dioxide. In the modern world, the carbon dioxide is removed from the atmosphere in rain, as dilute carbonic acid rain, that then reacts with silicate rocks and gets washed to the ocean and eventually, you know, forms carbon in sediment, carbonates and organic matter. But if you're in a snowball, the temperature is way below freezing everywhere. Snow can't absorb carbon dioxide, so there's no way of getting the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, so it builds up. You get a stronger and stronger and stronger greenhouse effect. And eventually, after millions of years, you have an atmosphere that's maybe 10% carbon dioxide rather than just a couple hundred parts per million. And you get enough carbon dioxide, you actually melt the ice. And now as soon as you start to melt the ice, you're replacing white ice with dark water. So you're then absorbing more radiation. So that same feedback now works in reverse, and you get this violent deglaciation that occurs very, very fast, a couple thousand years, and yet you still have this huge overload of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So the glacial event, last millions of years, is then suddenly terminated, and you have the greenhouse, the hottest climate the Earth has ever experienced, with annual mean temperature of 130 degrees Fahrenheit at the tropics.
Uh-huh. So now, what are the swing in temperatures that we would have been talking about from the coldest to the warmest?
It's 100 degrees Celsius, so that's like 212 degrees Fahrenheit.
Uh-huh.
And not in the extremes, but of the annual uh-huh. mean.
And the thought is that this could have happened. This freezing thawing actually could have happened several times. We have gone back and forth between cold, hot for a couple of times.
Towards the end of the Proterozoic, there are two events, one around 700 and one that ended at 635 million years before present. And then there's evidence for a much older snowball event around 2.2 billion years ago, about half the age of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And these two periods, the one around 2.2 and then the ones at 600-700 are the two periods when oxygen levels in the atmosphere rose.
I don't want to end up asking you so many questions that people are listening and said, well, I don't need to go hear this lecture because I've heard the whole story. But what I would ask, because the scientist that you mentioned, the man who coined the term Snowball Earth, he made some conclusions. And again, part of his interest was this sign of glacial activity in places where you would think was too warm. What was it that drew your interest to this and got you to spend time looking at it?
Well, Joe told me about this idea in a sweltering heat wave in Washington, D.C. in the summer of 1989. Now, it was interesting because he didn't believe it was possible for ice to be at sea level on the equator. And he's a paleomagnetist. That is, he studies the magnetization of old rocks. And one thing you can tell from this data is what latitude the rocks were deposited at. So he thought he would disprove the snowball idea by collecting samples and showing that they weren't at low latitude at all. And he assigned the project to an undergraduate. And she came up with results that demonstrated exactly the opposite, that in fact the ice had been at the equator at sea level. And so he was forced to think that the physicists were actually right. So Joe told me about this idea, and like everyone else, I said, "Oh, it's a nice idea, Joe, but it's a little radical." And so it was the same with me. I've been working in Namibia and southwestern Africa on rocks of this age, because there the glacial deposits are associated with carbonates, which normally form in the warmest parts of the ocean. So I went there because the climate problem was really, right in your face there. It took me years of work there, and I finally, the data just drove me to the conclusion that Kirschvick had to be more or less right. And then once I, accepted it, then it just seemed to open up so many, it just seemed to explain so many things that otherwise were totally mysterious.
Yeah. Generally speaking, how do other scientists feel about this idea right now at the moment? Do most say that seems to be a reasonable hypothesis, or are there a lot of them that still say no? I'm sorry, I just can't buy the basic idea.
I think there's still a lot of people sitting on the fence, but I think things have changed actually quite a bit the last couple of years. There've been, when the first hubbub started up, there was a lot of shouting going on, but there were also a lot of good projects that started. Now it takes 4 or 5 years for those projects to come to fruition, and so those results are coming out now, and they're generally pretty supportive. So I think that it's now pretty much generally acknowledged that these were the most extreme climates in Earth history, and the debate and the controversy is about the details. Was the tropical ocean completely covered with thick ice, or were there significant areas where the ice was thin enough where you could do photosynthesis, there'd be light to penetrate, or were there in fact fairly large areas of open water in the tropics? Those are sort of the three options, three flavors of snowball Earth, and I think that's the nature of the controversy now.
I guess some people are saying, well, it was more like slushy.
Yeah, frozen ocean with holes in it is the slush ball.
Yeah. Our guest, let me introduce again, our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Paul Hoffman. He's a professor of geology at Harvard University and is one of the leading proponents of this theory that we're talking about here that has come to be called Snowball Earth, and he's going to be giving a talk about it this afternoon, 4 o'clock on the U of I campus, another one of these events organized to mark the anniversary, the centennial, 100th anniversary of the Illinois State Geological Survey. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let's go on and talk a little bit about something else, because I suppose that there are some people that say, well, that's all very interesting, but that in a sense, and what happened 600 million years ago really, so what? There is also an idea that, in fact, there is a relationship between this period and what happened here and the very dramatic growth of life. Not that there wasn't life before, but not like what we saw after, that happens also about 600 million years ago.
Yeah, everybody wants to know about the origin of multicellular animals. We have a long history of, microbes before that time, and of algae, including multicellular algae. But multicellular animals arrive on the scene very late, around 600 million years or so. So, there's a fairly close correspondence. So when I first thought that Kirschvick might be right, naturally I hoped that these extreme climate changes might explain, this big step in evolution, perhaps by creating a series of genetic bottlenecks because of environmental degradation, only a few survivors, and then you'd have a re-radiation, another bottleneck, and a sort of genetic flush, and maybe that might have contributed to this extraordinary change in the types of organisms that were around. Now, as the timing became clearer, the time correspondence didn't look so good. The real Cambrian explosion, when you get a great diversification of shelly organisms, that's about 100 million years after the last snowball. So that, for a while, looked like that was too big a time gap for any causal relationship.
But now you think 100 million years is in the grand scale of things, is maybe not that much?
Well, a guy named Nick Butterfield has recently interpreted something that's been known for a while, and that is there are not many fossils during the time of the snowball Earth. And the main fossil record of these little organic-walled microfossils that represent some kind of plankton that were swimming around the surface ocean. And very soon after the last snowball event, maybe 10 million years, 20 million years, they suddenly get a lot bigger, and they have all sorts of spines. And the rate of turnover, that's the rate of extinction and speciation, increases by about two orders of magnitude. And Nick Butterfield thinks that this is a response for the first predators that are living off eukaryotic organisms, that is, organisms with cells that have nuclei. And these are generally much larger organisms than bacteria or archaea. So this would represent the first multicellular animals that actually predated on these larger organisms. So they would have had a full intestinal tract, and they could be more advanced. We call these the eumetazoa. Now, that's getting back fairly close. Now, using what's called molecular clocks, that is where you take living organisms and you take parts of their genetic makeup and you sequence that, and then you compare one organism to another, and of course they're rather different. And if you assume that these mutations have come into play at a steady rate over time, then you can take two organisms whose last common ancestor is known and use that to calibrate the genetic difference between two animals whose last common ancestor is not known and project backwards in time as to when that should be. And the newest results from that are very close in having the eumetazoa evolving right around the time where these changes that are observed in the fossil record in these plankton, and that puts the initiation of the eumetazoa very close to the last snowball event. So perhaps there is a connection, although the radiation started quite a bit earlier than the so-called Cambrian explosion, which is now thought of as really not being so much the origination of all these different types of organisms, but rather when they all acquired armaments for protection or for predation, and it's seen as sort of the first great arms race.
Very good. We have some callers here. Why don't we talk with them? Line one in Champaign, we'll start there. Hello.
Good morning. Interesting program.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, could the tilt of the Earth been caused by the snowball age, and could the dinosaurs have lived before that time?
Yeah, well, these are quite a long time before the evolution of the dinosaurs. And so the dinosaurs really come in after around 250 million years ago, and we're back about twice that age. Now, the tilt of the orbit, now this is really interesting. When a geologist first discovered that there were glacial deposits on the equator, some people advanced a very interesting hypothesis, and that was that the rotation axis of the Earth was actually lying down on its side, like Uranus. And so Uranus, the rotation axis, is in the plane of the ecliptic. And that completely alters the climate, and it makes the poles hotter than the equator. And it's really because with that kind of an orbit during the summer, the sun is directly overhead all throughout the whole diurnal cycle, 24 hours a day. Well, it was only 20 hours a day back 700 million years ago. And that could explain why the glacial deposits were on the equator.
But
but we don't believe it, because the carbonates, which represent the warmest parts of the ocean, were also on the equator, whereas with highly oblique orbit, the carbonate should have been on the poles.
Okay.
Well, Well, do they have any idea at all why the poles got tilted?
Well, the tilt that we do have is probably the result of the giant impact that formed the moon. Okay, so within about 30 million years of the formation of the solar system, the Earth got hit by another planet about the size of Mars, or maybe a little bit larger, got hit obliquely, and a huge chunk of the Earth plus parts of the impactor got spewed out and then coagulated to form the moon. And the moon is a very unusual object. We're the only planet that has a moon that is as large as a fraction of the mass of the Earth. And and much of the orbital characteristics of the Earth might have stemmed from that great collision.
And could the moon have come from where the Pacific Ocean is?
We do not believe that the Pacific Ocean originated from the from part of the Earth spinning out into orbit. That was one of the ideas, the fission idea, that the Earth was spinning very fast early on, and then part of it sort of got spun out into space and formed the moon and left a hole that's the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that the angular momentum of the Earth-Moon system is way too great to have originated with the from the solar system. It almost certainly results from a collision, a chance collision during the final stages of planetary accretion.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go to we'll talk with someone else in Urbana this time. Line number 3. Hello.
Yes, listening to your explanation makes me realize how important, once again, basic research is, just for the sake of research. Would you repeat your hypothesis again, please? I tuned in just as it was over.
Yeah, so the idea is that this glaciated state would result from an ice albedo feedback. And so on a planet that has polar ice caps, if it gets colder, those ice caps get bigger, and they're white, and they reflect the sun that falls on them, and so there's an additional cooling effect just due to the change in the color. And so if you get too much ice, it's unstable, and that you get a runaway effect, and it's unstoppable, and the entire planet gets covered with ice. Now, not exactly certain why it started to get colder around this time. One idea is that there were a lot of continents in low latitudes, and the carbon dioxide that is in the atmosphere is removed ultimately from the atmosphere by weathering of rocks, which is most intense in the tropics. So if you have more continents in the tropics, then you have more consumption of CO2, and you get, and so the climate system adjusts to a colder global climate.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. So also this depends upon perhaps a different arrangement of the land mass than we have now.
That's right. And ironically, having more continents in the tropics leads to a colder global climate. And having more continents in high latitudes, like we have today, tends to lead to a warmer climate. Now, that's not exactly what we see. In the last 50 million years, the climate has been getting colder and colder. So obviously, there are other factors at work as well.
One of the, I gather, I'm sure one of the questions that people have when you talk about this extreme period of glaciation does anyone think there is a possibility that something like this could happen again?
Yeah. It gets less and less likely as time goes on because the sun is getting brighter and brighter. So the brightness, the luminosity of the sun has increased by 30% over the history of the solar system. And this in itself is quite remarkable because if the sun was 30% dimmer, the Earth should have been in a snowball in at least half of its lifetime. And yet we know we've had liquid water on the surface of the Earth most of the time for the last 3.5 billion years. So a very basic question is, what is it about the Earth that has kept the Earth in a for the most part in a very narrow temperature range, despite this huge increase in the solar forcing? And James Walker from University of Michigan was the one who figured this out, and it's related to this weathering business. And what happens is if it gets warmer, the weathering reactions go faster, so you increase the rate at which CO2 is being pulled down, so that limits how warm it can get. And conversely, if it gets colder, the weathering becomes slower, so there's less consumption of CO2, so it puts a brake on how cold it can get. And so this snowball is really is an interaction of these two feedbacks, this sort of negative feedback that's controlling things due to the weathering, which is very powerful, and it's what gets you out of the snowball eventually. But it's very slow. The feedback takes a million years to come into operation. And the other feedback is the positive feedback from the ice albedo, and that comes into play in only a few months. So the ice albedo can get out of control, you know, but it gets reined in the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, this period when things got completely frozen over, this would have gone on for a long time. We're talking about millions.
Yeah, unless there's some accident that brings the snowball to the end, like a huge impact or something like that. Yeah, it's going to take millions of years to build up the CO2. So we don't know exactly how high the CO2 has to be. It depends on the nature of the ice. And that's one of the things. There's a lot of work being done and a fair bit of controversy about right now. And that's going to control how long it will last.
Yeah. And you said that once you get to the point where you get carbon dioxide built up sufficiently so that you start to have a greenhouse effect and things start to get warmer again, that the thaw can happen pretty quickly, as in thousands, maybe a couple of thousand years?
Once you start to open up, then it happens fast because you have the ice albedo feedback working in reverse. So as soon as you open up the tropical ocean, you got dark water that absorbs 90% of the solar radiation as opposed to the ice, which only absorbs about half. And so there's an additional warming effect, which makes
more
melting, which makes more water. And
how long do you think that it would have taken for the to get to the point where everything was all frozen?
Okay, so a group in Vienna have been looking at the deposits right at the end of the glaciation, and they've been looking for extraterrestrial dust. And what they use for that is the platinum element iridium. Okay, it's the same thing that was used to discover the impact that killed the dinosaurs. Okay, but here, what they're saying is the iridium is coming as from meteorites and from extraterrestrial dust falling to the Earth all the time. But if the Earth is completely frozen, then all that stuff's going to get in the ice, and it's going to melt out of the ice at the end of the glaciation. And if you measure the concentration of this concentrated layer, if you can find it, then you have some idea of how long-lived that ice has been. Okay? So a friend of mine in South Africa provided four drill cores from Zambia, where there's a big mining area, which goes through this proper stratigraphic horizon. And in all four places, there's a big increase in iridium concentration, about a part per billion, which doesn't sound like very much, but it's a huge increase over the background. Okay? So they have estimated from that the residence time of the ice, that is the length of time over which that material must have accumulated in the ice and then dropped out, is around 12 million years, assuming the same rate of iridium infall as now, which is about the best assumption you can make.
About 12 million years to get all frozen over.
And that's pretty consistent with the climate models, which basically say, well, how much CO2 is coming out? How long would it take to build up enough CO2, assuming that no CO2 leaves the atmosphere? And they get a similar figure, anywhere from a few million years to maybe 20 million years.
Yeah. And just a couple thousand to...
And maybe a couple thousand for it all to go.
Now, do you think that this happened more than once to this dramatic extent?
Yeah, I think you can make a reasonable case for three times. Two at the end of the Proterozoic, one at the beginning.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. He's a geologist. He's professor of geology, in fact, at Harvard University, Paul Hoffman. And he's here to talk about this, the idea of Snowball Earth, as part of a celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Illinois State Geological Survey. His talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock, room 228, Natural History Building on the U of I campus. That's on West Green. And it's open to anyone who would like to attend. And questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe I return to something that we talked about a little bit earlier And perhaps this is something more, better addressed by a biologist, but I'm sure it's something that, that I know that you have thought about. And that is one of the initial objections. We talked about the fact that some scientists initially reacted to the idea of snowball Earth by saying, well, if the Earth got all frozen over, that would be it. It would never unthaw. And you talked about how one might explain how that would, using natural ongoing processes, how you could explain, in fact, well, we could tell you how that could unthaw. The other thing that some scientists said was, well, if we get the entire Earth frozen over and we get the oceans frozen down to a depth of, you know, who knows, a mile more, then nothing is going to survive. So there would be no life left. But I guess that, in fact, now we know that there are living things that can survive under the very harshest conditions this planet has. And there is reason to believe that, in fact, some living things could have survived this, the planet being completely frozen over like this.
Yeah, it's remarkable the variety of organisms that are living in ice and under ice in Antarctica. And the climate in Antarctica today is broadly similar to snowball Earth on the equator. But the real crux of the issue is the following. We know from the fossil record that there are eukaryotic algae. Okay, and these are organisms that do photosynthesis that evolved a billion years or so or more ago, and they're still with us. Okay, and these are very distinctive, and there's several clades of eukaryotic algae. They're very similar to modern forms, so they must have survived. Luckily for us, they're our ancestors. And so the difficulty is that if the surface temperatures are below freezing everywhere, then at the surface there's sunlight, but there's no liquid water. And if the ice is thick everywhere, then at the base of the ice there's liquid water. The water isn't much colder than the deep ocean today, but there are no photons. So for the survival of eukaryotic algae, you've got to have somewhere where there's both liquid water and photons.
And is there such a place? Are there other places where there's both liquid water? Essentially, you've got to have light, right? You've got to have somebody.
Yeah.
He's giving me this look like, you know, you're doing this again. you're asking me all these questions, and now no one's going to want to. I'm sure plenty of people will go and hear the talk.
Well, I think it's in cracks. I think the cracks are the place where, because all the ice is flowing all the time, this floating ice, flowing towards the equator because it's warmer there and the ice is thinner. And so the ice has to flow around the continents and islands, and wherever it meets the seabed, it tends to freeze, but the floating ice is still moving. So the ice is cracking all the time. And if you look at ice cracks and shelf ice in Antarctica, it's teeming with organisms. Mm. And they're very interesting organisms. They have to have evolved complex development, different stages, because the cracks open, the cracks freeze over with ice, the ice gets thicker, the brine, you know, it's a complex cycle of crack development and evolution. And so I think it's a very interesting an ecosystem where organisms could have survived and did survive.
Well, you were talking earlier about the fact that one of the appealing things about the snowball Earth hypothesis is that it explains a number of other observable things. There are these different things that you can see, different kinds of evidence, and this will explain all of those things. Are there yet unanswered questions? Some things that are really interesting and important that still you don't have a good answer for?
Yeah. I mean, it's like Darwin said, you know, Darwin wrote in The Origin, he said, well, he actually didn't write in The Origin. He wrote it on little cards that he clipped into copies of The Origin, which he sent to people. And he said, I cannot believe that a false hypothesis would explain so many different classes of phenomena. Mm. Okay, mm-hmm. But there's lots that's unknown about evolution. So it's the same with snowball. What we have here is a world. It's a functioning world. It has an atmosphere and an ocean. And it's warmer in the equator and colder in the poles. And so it's doing its own thing. But it's a completely different world than the one we have. And so we've got to try to understand how this world could have or should have, if it existed, operated. Because if we can't do that, then we don't know how to test, how to use the geologic record to test whether these events actually did occur. Okay? So what we need to try to work out how such a world would have functioned is bright people with excellent imaginations and no experience, which is the definition of a good graduate student. Mm. And because you don't want to be impeded by the world we live in, because this is a different planet, but one that plays by its own rules.
Well, we have someone else to talk with. Let's do that. Someone is in Terre Haute, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. My question is, with all these extremes in the climate that have gone on in geologic history, how do we know today to what extent global warming is anthropogenic? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I think the clearest evidence is that we have very good records that go back in time, and so we can judge the present change that has occurred, although, of course, there's about a 20-year lag time between when you change the CO2 in the atmosphere, for example, and how long it takes the climate to adjust. So, you know, it won't be for another 20 years before we know the full impact of the present levels of CO2, never mind the increase we'll see between now and then. But in any case, just the change that's occurred in the last 100 years, and particularly in the last 25 years, is just off scale relative to any of the natural variation that you see over the last 10,000 years. And in fact, to see any event that's comparable to the present experiment that we're doing with the Earth in terms of the magnitude and the speed of the change, you have to go back to 55 million years ago. There was a natural event that looks very much like this one, although the world was very different at that time. It was much warmer to begin with. So, but in recent history, like since the last ice age, there's no indication in the record of any change that's as large and as rapid as what we are currently observing.
Hmm. So the question the caller asks about how certain we can be that the warming that we've seen, roughly speaking, over the last century is the result of human activity. That is, that it didn't just happen and it wasn't nature. It was because of things that we're doing. You believe that there is good to date, there is good evidence to show that it is a direct result of human activity, would not have happened otherwise if we weren't around?
I think the vast majority of climate scientists, probably 98% of them, believe that most of the warming is anthropogenic. Now, there are natural effects in there as well, but we don't even know whether the natural effects were towards warming or cooling. And I think it's as equally likely as it is the one as opposed to the other. So most of the warming that we observe is believed to be due to anthropogenic forcing. And why not? I mean, we know the CO2 has risen. We've been measuring it. And before that, we have samples of the air from ice cores. And the significance of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, that's been known since the 19th century. So we know from theory that there should have been an effect. The effect can be modeled. The warming that we've seen can be modeled based on the changes that in the atmosphere that we can calculate and observe. So it all hangs together. So I think that the vast majority of climate scientists, and I know a great many of them, are firmly convinced that these changes are mainly anthropogenic.
Next caller is in Champaign. We'll talk with someone here, line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It's my understanding that the Earth, when it was initially created, is much hotter than it is now, and it's been kind of a slow, long cooling. Now, if that is in fact true, which it might not be, there will be probably much more volcanic action and so forth and movement in the crust versus this molten core of essentially iron. Now, why would this several billion years cooling process result in this ice condition? It seems like at the very beginning of the Earth, it would have had much more volcanic action. The heat of the initial creation of the Earth from the core would have been manifest to the rest of the Earth, and it just doesn't seem that to get to where we are today, in the climate we have today, we would have gone through periods when this core would not have been as active as it is now in terms of volcanic ash coming up and forming hydroscopic nuclei and all of that. Is the Earth, in fact, cooling in its essential core?
Yes, the interior of the Earth is slowly cooling. Now, that doesn't necessitate that the surface of the Earth is cooling. In fact, the surface temperature of the Earth is adjusted to maintain a balance between the incoming radiation we get from the sun and the outgoing radiation. And so the surface temperature is really independent of the interior temperature. Now, the surface temperature, if anything, should have been a lot colder in the distant past because the sun was a lot dimmer. However, the hotter interior of the Earth does mean that there would be more greenhouse gases potentially coming out of volcanoes, and that would have tended to make the atmosphere richer in greenhouse gases, which would be helpful because we need that to have overcome that dimmer sun in those days. So what we believe is that this feedback involving the chemical reactions in rock weathering is what allows the CO2 to slowly decline over geologic time to adjust for the increasing brightness of the sun.
And will the sun get to another stage where it's dimmer again, or is it on a steady state progression getting brighter and brighter?
It's going to get brighter and brighter, and we're headed towards Venus.
Okay.
So eventually the CO2 will all be removed, and then we will lose our thermostat, and then it'll get warmer and warmer, and eventually the oceans will boil off, and that'll be it.
Now, in terms of measurement, is there any way of knowing whether the Earth eventually will cool totally, and will that happen? Will the Earth cool totally before the sun burns infinitely, so to speak?
Yeah, no. It looks as if the sun will explode before the Earth cools.
Okay.
The Earth is probably only cooled on average. This is the Earth's interior by 100 or 200 degrees over the history of the planet.
Mm. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. And of course, the good news about all of this is we won't be here, so we don't have to worry about it.
No, this is the Venusian state is at least a billion years.
Well,
in the future.
Well, that one. Yeah, I'm not saying we shouldn't worry about global warming, but the
that we should worry about.
Yes, that we should worry about. But the long term death of the sun and what it means for the solar system, we probably don't need to worry about that.
Well, we'll be the seeds of another planet somewhere.
Yeah. Just for the kind of thing that we're talking about here, and I guess this is planetary science, you know, understanding about the Earth, how it was formed, how things have changed over time, how the Earth as we know it today is very different from the Earth that we would have known 600 million years ago or further. Is the benefit of knowing this it's simply a pure science kind of thing, and it just satisfies our need to know, which ultimately I guess is why we do science. We just want to know how things work and as understand as best as we can at any given point how things work.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, it's an amazing thing that you can tell the story of the Earth, and not just as a fanciful one, but a story that can be checked out and gradually discovered. But you never know when it's going to have a practical dividend. I mean, if there hadn't been atmospheric scientists, interested in what was going on in Antarctica for purely scientific reasons, we'd have never discovered the ozone hole. I mean, that could have been curtains. Mm-hmm. And currently, if we didn't have a record of climate over the last millennia, we wouldn't be in a position to be able to say whether the very modest warming that has been observed in the last 25 years is, you know, maybe it's just a little blip. It's because of the perspective we have from knowing the history of climate that we can say, no, this is not just a blip. This is a serious change that's going to play out over several thousands of years.
Hmm. How did you become interested in being a geologist? Was this something that started when you were young, or somewhere along the line in your education, somebody influenced you?
Yeah, so I visited the local museum to see the Knights in Armor, and it turned out that the museum staff ran field trips for young kids. I was about 7 years old on Saturdays, and one of the field trips was to quarry to collect fluorite and other nice minerals, and I got the collecting habit, and by the age of 11 or 12, I knew I was going to be a geologist and work for the Geological Survey of Canada and do great things. And
well, you seem to have done pretty well.
You know, nature really has written a great script.
So you were bitten by the rock bug when you were a kid.
Yeah, that's right.
No. And probably a lot of kids end up.
I had the great good fortune of discovering geology at an early age, and it's just never let me down.
Yeah. For as far as now Snowball Earth, that idea goes, and its future, that simply would be continuing to try to add to the base of knowledge, refine it a little bit more, answering more unanswered questions, looking for more evidence. Is there, so there's further that you can take this?
Sure. What is the real connection to biological evolution? What is the connection to the oxygenation of the atmosphere? Why did these events occur? Yeah, these are all unanswered questions.
Mm-hmm. What particularly engages you, like the thing that you don't know now that you'd really like to know?
I'd really like to know, how extensive the ice was on the ocean, because that really determines how long-lived the events are, and a lot about the chemistry that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I also just love being a geologist and going to the field.
What other kinds of things besides Snowball Earth? What other kinds of things are you interested in?
Yeah. Well, early in my career, I was interested in plate tectonics and how long plate tectonics has been going on. And so I worked a lot on demonstrating that plate tectonics has actually been in operation for most of Earth history.
You mean on a when I hear that, I guess what I think about is things like earthquakes. What is under the ground that we walk on shifts, and what that means. Or you're thinking about in the larger sense of how it is we have the continents we have,
yeah,
and where the land is.
Why we have continents, why we have oceans, why they're different, why we have volcanoes, why we have great faults with earthquakes, why things move around, the geography has changed continually over time. Yeah, and no other planet has plate tectonics. So even when we understood finally that plate tectonics was going on, that the surface of the Earth was moving all the time, it didn't necessarily mean that it had been like this throughout all of Earth history, because as the caller said, the Earth is cooled.
And does this have something to do with the fact that we have solid stuff on top of liquid stuff, that at the core the Earth is in a liquid state?
I think having the water is hugely important.
Having
the surface water, which of course gets into the interior. So I think the water is hugely important, not only for biology, but also for tectonics. And that's liquid water. And the reason we have liquid water is because of our climate. And so that's another reason why, explaining why this planet is near the critical point of water, has water vapor, liquid water, and water ice all coexisting because of the temperature on the range on the Earth. And it's been like that for most of Earth history, despite these huge changes going on around us. I think that's, that is just an endlessly fascinating thing, which is why our planet is so unusual.
This is maybe a different kind of question and gets outside of the area that you're interested in, but and I suppose I could be talking with someone who does more earthquake kind of stuff. But given how difficult it is to understand what is going on under the Earth that we walk on, and how much we would like to know that at least beforehand, do you think that we will get to a point where we have a good enough understanding so that we could be able to predict serious, devastatingly serious seismic events?
I suspect not. I think it's like radioactivity. You can do it statistically, but you can't predict the timing of an individual event. And so you can say that the probability of a mega thrust earthquake, like a magnitude 8.5 to 9.5, huge, in the Pacific Northwest, the likelihood of that happening sometime in the next couple hundred years is highly probable. Okay, but when it's going to happen, I suspect that we may never be able to do that.
Yeah, and we have one of those around here that we wonder about a little bit too.
Yeah.
Well, at that, I think we will finish up with, again, to mention that our guest for this part of Focus 580, Dr. Paul Hoffman, will be talking about Snowball Earth this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus. It's one of the events that is going on to mark the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the Illinois State Geological Survey. Snowball Earth, Science or Snow Job. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock, 228 of the Natural History Building on the U of I campus. That's 1301 West Green on the Urbana side. He's Professor Dr. Paul Hoffman, a Sturgis Hooper Professor of Geology at Harvard University. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Pleasure.